This is Washington Watch Weekly, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. Now, here's our host, the president of the Family Research Council, Tony Perkins.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. President Obama went before the nation this past week and presented his State of the Union address. The major focus of his one-hour-plus speech was income inequality. He touched on education, quality jobs, government-funded research, and forcing businesses to pay more through an increase in the minimum wage as the means to income equality. Former Undersecretary at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and Mayor of Cincinnati, Ken Blackwell, said the president lacks a basic understanding of economics. He explains in just a moment. And Congressman Scott Garrett of New Jersey responds to President Obama's vow to act alone if Congress won't go along with his plans. Also, a House subcommittee held hearings to dig deeper into the growing threat to religious liberty in the military. Mississippi Congressman Alan Nunley joins me with the results of that hearing. Let me encourage you to go to the website, TonyPerkins.com, and you can find out more about the guests that are here on the weekend edition of Washington Watch. Well, a lot of buzz this week about the president's State of the Union address, and I was actually in the House chamber on Tuesday night when the president spoke, and one of the moments that left me scratching my head was when he started talking about raising the minimum wage. Now, I think it shows a lack of a basic understanding of economics. Now, listen to this.
In the years since I asked this Congress to raise the minimum wage, five states have passed laws to raise theirs. Many businesses have done it on their own. Nick Shute is here today with his boss, John Serrano. John's an owner of Punch Pizza in Minneapolis. And Nick helps make the dough. Only now he makes more of it. John just gave his employees a raise to $10 an hour, and that's a decision that has eased their financial stress and boosted their morale. Of course, to reach millions more, Congress does need to get on board. Today, the federal minimum wage is worth about 20% less than it was when Ronald Reagan first stood here. And Tom Harkin and George Miller have a bill to fix that by lifting the minimum wage to $10.10. It's easy to remember, 10-10. This will help families. It'll give businesses customers with more money to spend. It does not involve any new bureaucratic program. So join the rest of the country. Say yes. Give America a raise. Give them a raise.
On Wednesday, FRC Senior Fellow for Family Empowerment, former Mayor of Cincinnati and former Undersecretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Ken Blackwell, joined me with his thoughts.
What you saw last night was a classic example of Obama's imperial presidency. He has tried to concentrate power in the executive branch, and he has now drank his own Kool-Aid, where he thinks that he can decree economic policy from the Oval Office. But what it really showed was his glaring misunderstanding or lack of understanding of how a free market system works. It brought to mind what Winston Churchill said: capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings, socialism is the equal sharing of misery. And I think that's what we saw last night, was a clever way of Mr. Obama saying that he was going to redistribute misery across the country.
But Kent, look, you have been in government. You've been mayor of one of the nation's largest cities. The real effects of the minimum wage is that when you raise it, you actually raise the cost of many of the basic items that people have to acquire and buy. But you also, what you do by raising the minimum wage is that you price some people out of the job market.
Oh, absolutely, particularly low-income young people who have not, one, developed the skills or attained the education to compete for higher-paying jobs. The other thing that he did was that he threw a bone to labor unions and federal employees, because essentially once you start the ripple effect of raises at the bottom of the scale, because of the way contracts have been written, all of a sudden people get raises, even if they're not contributing a greater value. And you have some business people, particularly small business owners, who are playing with a small margin. They then make decisions to either move into technology, where they reduce the number of workers that they need, or they just eliminate the workers. So in a roundabout way, Mr. Obama is doing a disservice to the very people that he claims that he wants to help.
Exactly. Because, and let me give you two examples of that, because he made reference to young African American males who are having difficulty getting into the job market. And as you said, if you lack, maybe it's the education or the skills, you got to land that first job. Because when you get that first job, then you can kind of build up. And I think from our perspective, Ken, from the conservative perspective, we don't see the minimum wage as a destination or a place where people are going to stay, but simply it's a stepping stone, that entry-level job. So they're hurt by this. But then secondly, it was interesting out west when I was meeting with Hispanic pastors and others talking about the immigration issue, that this type of policy actually fuels the demand for undocumented workers because they'll work for less than minimum wage.
Absolutely. You know, this is, a classic case of him focusing on the wrong thing. Income inequality isn't the problem. It is the doors to mobility, upward mobility, being shut on people. And it's ironic that this president's policies go directly after those things that would, in fact, give folks greater mobility. One of the things that we know is that children who grow up in families with a mom and dad, if they get an education and they stay out of unwedlock births until they are married, one of the things that they do is that they tend to be more upward mobile than those who engage in premarital sex, get locked into out of wedlock births, drop out of school. You start the cycle of downward mobility as opposed to upward mobility. But yeah, the president, one, he is in the forefront on the attack of school choice. He is one of the enemies to traditional marriage. So he concerns himself with income inequality when he should be focused on encouraging folks to use those things that would give them upward mobility.
All right, absolutely. You know, I want to, that last point you made, I want to touch on that because twice in his speech, and I was taking copious notes as I was sitting there listening. I couldn't bring my iPhone in, so I had to listen. I felt like I was back in school. Sean Hannity was sitting over a catty corner to me, and occasionally we would make eye contact and roll our eyes at something he said. But he said the greatest key to upward to mobility, he said, was quality education, and then later he said access to a good job. Well, as you made reference, not only the research that we do here at the Family Research Council through our Marriage and Religion Research Institute, but Harvard released a study earlier this week saying exactly the same thing, that the greatest element in determining social mobility is a child growing up in a home with a mom and a dad that are married in a community of children who are growing up with moms and dads that are married. And as you pointed out, his policies are undermining that at every step.
Oh, absolutely, Tony. And I think it's important that we call him out on that, because when he talks about income inequality, what he is playing is he's playing his hatred and envy cards. That's what he's trying to breed with that. He's trying to play the negative game of divide and take away. This is supposed to be the president that didn't see red states or blue states, but just the United States of America. His behavior and his initiatives run counter to those promises. And I think we need to call him out at every turn, because he, in fact, taken us in the wrong direction.
Again, that was FRC Senior Fellow for Family Empowerment, Ken Blackwell. Find out more about Ken, go to the website tonyperkins.com. While you're there, be sure and sign up for my daily update so you can stay up to date on what's happening as it pertains to faith, family, and freedom. All right, when we come back, Congressman Scott Garrett of New Jersey joins me. Don't go away. We're coming back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
Wish you were in D.C. so you could attend all the exciting FRC events? Now you can be. FRC University provides anyone access to all past lecture events from anywhere. Experts from many fields, including professors, members of Congress, policy analysts, and pastors, give their analysis of today's cutting-edge issues. FRC professionally archives each of these events and provides a link to them through the FRC University webpage. Wondering about the most recent Supreme Court term? Check out Ken Klukowski's analysis of the most important cases. Want to hear an inspiring story of the power of the gospel? Listen to Dr. Rosaria Butterfield's journey from being a lesbian professor at Syracuse University to a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, transformed and serving him as a pastor's wife. These exciting events, and many others, can be accessed at www.frc.org/university.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Thanks so much for being with us. Let me encourage you to go to the website, tonyperkins.com. You can find out more about all of our guests that appear on the weekend edition. As well, you can sign up for my daily update right there on the website, tonyperkins.com. Well, I want to stay on the theme of the State of the Union, but I want to get a congressional perspective. Now, the president, who has consistently stretched the limits of his constitutional authority, vowed to act alone Tuesday night if Congress would not concede to his policy demands. Now, how does Congress feel about the president's threat to go it alone? Now, here's a clip from the president's State of the Union address when he made those comments.
Some require congressional action, and I'm eager to work with all of you. But America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
So how do members of Congress feel about the president's threat? That's what I asked New Jersey Congressman Scott Garrett on Wednesday. Your thoughts after the president essentially said, look, to Congress, you can either act or I'm going to do it on my own. Is this a reflection of the president having no leadership ability?
Well, I heard your description just before it came on saying that this is the president poking the eye of the members of the eye of Congress. I would just had a caveat to that. I think he's really poking the American public in the eye when he does that, because he's really saying, not just to Congress, but to everyone, if you're not ready to work with me under the way I want to do things, I'm going to do it my way, regardless whether you agree with me or not. And of course, the polls are right now showing is that the Americans don't agree with him. They don't. Almost two-thirds of the American public don't have confidence in him. Almost half of the American public don't trust him. The majority of Americans don't agree with him on what he did to them with regard to health care and Obamacare. But he's just, as your expression, I mean, apropos, poking everyone in the eye by saying, if you don't like it, too bad, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah, it was almost, I thought it felt like I was kind of witnessing a presidential tantrum. You know, I'm going to do this. I've got the pen. I'm going to make it happen. And either there was a sense of arrogance with this. I mean, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond to this. My thoughts, it was kind of arrogant to sit there in front of the elected representatives of the people and say, if you agree with me, fine, we're going to go forward. If you don't agree with me, I'm going forward anyway.
Yeah, I mean, someone made the comparison to, you know, the class bully when you're in school. He said, you know, I want to do things with the group as long as you do it my way. And that's what he was saying to Congress and to the American public last night. I'm willing to work with you as long as I get my way. And if I don't, I get to pick up the ball because I brought the ball and take it home and just run off the field with it. And that's really what he's saying. But he's also saying something else. He's also saying that he thinks that he has the ability, the innate ability and the legal ability, I guess, to solve a lot of America's problems by cutting red tape, expediting permits, creating greater government efficiency. Well, I wondered when I heard him say all those things, if he has that innate ability, legal ability and what have you to do all those things, my goodness, why hasn't he done them for the last 5 years? And get us out of this recession and get us out of this quagmire and get people back to work. But I guess the answer, that question answers itself. He does not have that ability.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins, joined by Congressman Scott Garrett of New Jersey. You made a comment last night about the value of talk as the president was laying these things out, that there needs to be a little bit more than just talk.
Right. It's the fact that talk, as the saying goes, talk is cheap, but confidence is priceless. Talk is so cheap, and I think that's why the American public has such a low opinion in general of politicians, and as I mentioned before, why the American public as a whole has such a low opinion right now of the President of the United States, because we've had so much talk out of Washington and so much talk out of this administration, so many promises. The promises that you can keep your health care if you want it, you can keep your doctors if you want it. You promise that you can lower your health care cost by $2,500 if you just do such and such. That was just all, we find out now, that was all just so much talk, no truth to any of it.
What's been the talk among your colleagues? Was there a sense of, look, this guy needs, if he wants to get this done, he's got to work with Congress. We've got to have a conversation. You can't just throw these things out there. What's been the response among your colleagues?
Well, all those points and more. I think the people that I hang around with are basically optimists at heart. They're people who want to do, my friends and colleagues in Congress want to do well and good for the American public and for the people that they represent at home. We understand that so many of our friends and neighbors back at home are suffering right now. They don't have jobs. Their jobs aren't paying well. They're having a hard time make ends meet, paying the bills, getting their kids into college, paying those bills, and on the problems go. And so you try to remain optimistic at a State of the Union address that the president will actually come forward and say, I'll work with you. Let's put aside our differences. Let's find our common goals. Let's see how we can solve these things. But, you know, we didn't hear any of that last night from the president. And that's why even the optimists among us were disappointed.
Now, he didn't, I described it more as platitudes and hollow promises. There wasn't a lot of substance in it, but given the benefit of the doubt, if some of the more specifics that the president put forward last night, if you thought they were going to work and get the economy moving again and would help the families that you just made reference to, would you support them?
Well, sure. And that's a question, a variation of a question that I get hit by other reporters last night. You know, is there anything that you agree with the president in his speech? And I said, well, I agree with the 30,000-foot level goals, and the goals are to get people back to work, have higher-paying jobs, increase wages and the like, improve education. I think we all agree on the ultimate goals. The dilemma, the difficulty, and what stops this administration from accomplishing any of these things is in the methodology to get there. He thinks that the solution to all those problems is create more programs, provide, you know, raise taxes, spend more money, and so on down the line, and we know the history of that approach is a failed one. Looking back over the last 5 years, but last several five decades, probably.
Right, and I want one thing in particular. We're almost out of time, but the issue of the minimum wage. I get the sense that for many in the Democrat, and I don't want to speak for all of them, but I just got this sense from the president and many when they talk about minimum wage, that they see that as a destination, where Republicans see the minimum wage as a barrier to have a living wage.
Right. Again, the goals. The goal, I think, for all of us is that we all should aspire that the American public will have a wage that they can live by. But a minimum wage is never going to be a living wage.
Right.
We want Americans to be able to have not just jobs, but careers. We want the actual wages that people get paid to go increase. But the way to do that is to promote more private sector jobs, promote more private sector high-paying jobs, promote more private sector careers that people can go into and actually solve all those problems I talked about before. paying your bills, getting into college, and so on and so forth. But just putting people in at the very bottom and say you're going to stay there for the rest of life at that minimum level is not what I think most or any Americans really strive for in this country.
Congressman Garrett, thanks so much for being with us. Again, it was great to be with you last night, and thanks for your insights and joining us today.
Thank you so much. Take care now.
Again, that was Congressman Scott Garrett of the 5th Congressional District of New Jersey. When we come back, Mississippi Congressman Alan Nunley joins us to talk about a hearing on Capitol Hill this week dealing with religious freedom in our nation's military. Don't go away. We're back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch in just a moment.
We are grateful for the men and women who are defending our great country. Many of our soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, and Coast Guardsmen have risked their lives so we can remain free. Free to speak our minds, free to associate, free to practice our faith as we see fit. But these same men and women are facing threats to the very freedoms that they're protecting. Many members of our military are motivated by a deep and abiding Christian faith. Their faith is not merely an add-on, but the foundation and motivation for their sacrifice. Some of them are facing pressure to abandon that faith, to hide it away, to minimize its uncomfortable implications, or even deny its restorative and hopeful power. We won't stand for that. We believe that their freedoms are worth protecting. To follow this conversation on Facebook or Twitter, find us at #MilitaryFreedom. That's #MilitaryFreedom.
Well, after months of complaints from those in uniform, a hearing was held in regards to religious freedom in the military. Wednesday's hearing was the first opportunity members of Congress have had to question the Defense Department publicly about the military's war on religious liberty. Congressman Alan Nunley, who represents the 1st Congressional District of Mississippi, was a part of the hearing, and he joined me on Thursday to give me the details. Now, Congressman, what were some of the major takeaways for you in yesterday's hearing? Any new information or anything that causes you to be encouraged that the military might be responding?
No. In fact, I view the hearing yesterday as the very bottom rung of a ladder, and I hope we continue to climb it. I commend Subcommittee Chairman Joe Wilson from South Carolina for convening the hearing. And Joe, although I'm not on the committee, invited me to be a part because he knew that I had an interest. And I specifically spent time asking Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in charge of military policy, her name is Ms. Dee Benrod, about what you just identified. There just seems to be a pattern of cases over and over again. And when members of Congress asked the Department of Defense about those cases, the answer is, okay, well, that was an isolated incident, and it'll stop. And then, as I pointed out, we've had cases in Pennsylvania, in Fort Hood, Texas, in Camp Shelby, Mississippi. It's evidence it does not stop. So I have already talked to Mr. Wilson, who will be following it up with a letter, because Ms. Penrod's response was, well, that's outside the purview of my jurisdiction. I really can't answer that question. Well, I want to get this group, this Defense Equal Opportunity Management Institute, that's in charge of these seminars, and I want them to appear before a committee and answer questions as to who made these decisions, who thought this would be a good idea, and what role is it of the U.S. military to even have workshops on this subject.
Yeah, it's I share your frustration because as we have been now tracking this for the last, 2 years, it's really since the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it's become a major issue. Not all related to that, but it clearly for the president's radical social policy to be advanced in the military, religion has to be suppressed, and we're seeing that take place. But with each of these incidents that we have inquired about at the Pentagon and elsewhere, we get the same response. Oh, this was an isolated incident. It was not intentional. It was an oversight. Well, that doesn't give me a great level of confidence about our nation's military if there's so much of this is considered to be an oversight, that they're not watching. I mean, does that instill in you much confidence in our nation's military leadership?
That's exactly the question we want to ask. I mean, we've had military people that have been told, okay, if you are supporting an evangelical Christian organization, I take that to be my church, then you're subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Well, that's frightening. If a soldier, a man or woman in the military, makes a contribution to their church, and they're going to be hauled in before the UCMJ, that's very serious.
Yeah, and I know there were some questions in the hearing that were asked regarding the Southern Poverty Law Center, and if they were continuing to be a source for the Pentagon in their training materials, because that was one of the problems we found, is they're the ones that are labeling, they're an anti-Christian organization, been linked to domestic terrorism in federal court. And they were a source, but the response I understand that the committee received from the Pentagon officials was that didn't have an answer. They'd look into it.
And then one of the things that was most disturbing to me from the hearing is that it was acknowledged that there was a homily for the Catholic Church that was presented to churches all over the United States of America. But one sentence in that homily was stricken from the Catholic masses that occurred on United States military installations. And that decision was not made by the priest in charge of the church. It was made by the United States Department of Defense. And the sentence had to do with religious opposition to family planning in Obamacare.
Wow. I mean, that's... That clearly is, I would think, crossing the line. When you talk about separation of church and state, then you have the state walking in telling the church what it can preach and what it can't preach.
It's basic First Amendment freedoms.
All right, Congressman Nunley, thanks so much for being with us. As always, appreciate your insights, and thanks for asking those questions on the committee.
Thank you for what you do.
That was Mississippi Congressman Alan Nunley, who represents the 1st Congressional District. Let me encourage you to go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. You can find out more about all of today's topics and our guest who appeared here on the weekend edition of Washington Watch. You can also sign up for my daily update and find out more about our daily edition of Washington Watch. Well, folks, that's all we have time for. Thanks so much for being with us. And let me leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul. You've done everything you can do. You've prayed, you've prepared, you've taken your stand for the truth. Well, just keep standing.
Washington Watch Weekly is a donor-supported ministry of the Family Research Council.